The recordings are now started. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Sam. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's IRTPC call on Tuesday, the 2nd of October. We have James Bladel, Mike O'Connor, Kevin Erdman, Bob Mountain, Michele Nalon, Barbara Knight, Roy Dykes, Avery Doria, Simonetta the Tiger, Paul Diaz, Martin Gunder. We also have Volker Greimann, who is on the Adobe Connect and who has not yet joined the audio bridge. We also have Phil Corwin and Avery Doria. Apologies today noted from Alain Béranger. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Barry Cobb, Glenda Saint-Géry, Julia Charvolin, and myself, Gisela Gruber. I'd like to introduce Julia Charvolin to you as well. She's a new member of staff, and she'll be taking over from Natalie during her maternity leave. So welcome, Julia. And if I could also please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. I hope I haven't left anyone off the roll call, and over to you, James. Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie, and thank you for also introducing Julia. I saw her name on the list and thought perhaps we had gained a new member at this late stage in our work. So welcome, everyone. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Gisela. My apologies. So welcome to the IRTPC call for October 1st, 2012. We are very close to the end here, as we note from our agenda, but first up, does anyone have any changes or statements regarding their statement of interest? Please raise your hand at this time. Okay, and does anyone have any comments, questions, or additions to our agenda, which was circulated by Marika on the mailing list and is listed on the right-hand column in the chat room? I see Michele. Go ahead.
I just wanted to declare myself as a tree hugger, that's all.
Okay, thanks. And I wanted to, it's not really a comment on the agenda, but just an announcement that the next meeting will be our last meeting per our work plan and per the Toronto schedule. So the intention is to get whatever loose ends we have wrapped up today and then press forward with a review between these last couple of weeks and address any open items in our next call. I do have a bit of a problem, however. Murphy's Law, of course, I have been selected for jury duty next Monday. So while my American colleagues laugh behind my back, I will ask perhaps, and unfortunately for this critical call, I will ask our co-chair, Avery, to see if she can step in. And if not, then we may, if she also has a conflict, then we may ask staff to pick up the slack at that as well, because I will be completely incommunicado for at least 2 days, if not longer. So just a little bit of housekeeping there. Okay, so let's dive into our open issues. We have, thanks, Michele, for the note of solidarity there, but let's dive into issue number 3. And it looks like we had some, we still had some discussions relative to this issue of minor changes to registrar information and where the sensitivity of the locking mechanism would be to any kind of changes. And I think that Mikey had some language here, and this is the proposed language. Marika, if you don't mind, could you walk us through this language, or Marika or Mikey, walk us through this language, and we can see if we can put this issue to bed?
Doesn't work. I'm happy to do so, unless Mikey prefers to do it. But the current language in the report basically states indicate, and this relates to the change of registrant policy proposal. In the case of minor updates or correction, the registrar at its discretion may waive this requirement. And as you may recall, we had a quite lengthy discussion last week on this topic, where some felt uncomfortable by providing this kind of discretion without any, you know, firm rules on when this can be applied or not, which might, you know, create a kind of loophole for the policy. So as a result, I think Mikey suggested some different language to address that point, and what he submitted is In the case of minor updates or corrections, the registrar may waive this requirement at the request of the registrant. However, such waivers must be secured in a way that prevents an unauthorized person from requesting the action based exclusively on registrar account credentials or publicly available resources such as Whois. As a non-limiting example, registrars may want to consider out-of-band authentication based on information that cannot be learned from within the registrar account or publicly available resources such as Whois. The working group recommends that the IRTP Part C implementation review team is consulted by ICANN staff as it develops the implementation plan to ensure this recommendation is implemented in accordance with the intention of the working group.
Okay, thank you, Marika. I have Mikey in the queue first. So, go ahead, Mikey.
Thanks, James. The main point that I wanted to make was that, except for the first sentence, that whole long rest of sentence is just a copy and paste of other language. And so I'd focus the attention on the first sentence rather than debate the second one, because I think that second one appears several times in the document, and I have no strong feelings about changing that one. Thanks.
Hey, James.
Okay. Yeah, Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bob Mountain. Unfortunately, I'm actually driving, so I can't raise my hand to get into the queue. But
Safely, anyway.
So at some point, if you could add me to the queue for this particular discussion.
Go for it. I have myself in the queue, Bob, but I'll just put myself in the back. Go ahead now.
Okay, yeah, so I guess I just had a question for Mikey, actually. And, Mikey, would you consider the email address that's part of the data record, the Whois record, and, a validation that would involve the use of that email to be, what you would consider non-secure information, or would you consider, an email validation to be that used that information but required communication with that email to be would you consider that to be secure enough or, an approach that you would be okay with?
James, is it okay if I jump in front of you and answer, Bob?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, please.
Okay. Bob, I think what I would do is punt that to the implementation gang. I'm not the smartest guy in the world about developing secure authentication cycles, and so my interest is mostly in leaving the choice about minor or registrant, minor change or registrant in the hands of the registrant themselves. But in terms of the whole secure authentication thing, I would hate to preclude, a good way of getting that done, because I'm just not sure. I hate to equivocate like that, but
I would be in the same place as you. I just wasn't sure if you had sort of religion about use of that email that's in the public record. So I'd be exactly where you are. I think the forward pass approach is the appropriate one here. So
I mean, I think the worry about an email thing, of course, is always the standard, our hero has a Gmail address. There are lots of very well-known hacks of Gmail. They lose their email account credentials to a bad guy, and off we go to the races. So, I think what we need to do is kind of punt that particular issue to a group of people who are smarter about the subtleties than at least me.
Okay, thanks, gentlemen. I put myself in the queue on this very similar topic, but I'll go to Marika first. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just on the issue of punting, because direction we're punting is staff, and I think any kind of further detail or direction you can provide staff, in this effort would be really helpful. Because also looking at the implementation review team is likely going to consist of members that are also part of this working group. So I do want to avoid that you know, we hand this over to staff, and then my colleagues go and turn around and ask me, like, well, what did they mean here? And I'll have to tell them, well, the working group actually wanted you to figure out what this means and make suggestions. So, you know, if there's any way we can be more specific here, I think that would really help us as part of, you know, developing an implementation plan and you know, avoiding trying to figure out some of this stuff, basically in the later part of the process, which will only take more time.
Thanks, Marika. And that was kind of where I was going with this as well, is that, you know, that when we say we're going to punt or execute a forward pass, we have to be mindful that it's going over to staff and in some cases to the same people that are on the call now, or at least a subset of this group, so we should be careful. I had a different approach, Mikey, and I don't know if this is making things better or making things worse, so I'll just kind of lay it out there, is that I think we need to separate in this issue what we want registrars to do from what we want compliance to enforce. Because I think that when we commingle these things, we get in a little bit of trouble because we're saying things like we're now called on to say whether or not we believe that email is secure, and I agree with you 100% that it's usually a compromised email account that is the vector for a compromised registrar account, and that, you know, that I would hate to put any kind of language into a policy that would essentially say, okay, registrar, you are now on the hook in the event that the registrant loses control of their email account or something along those lines. So I think that while I don't really have any particular objections to the language that you've proposed, and I think it can get us over the or past this rough spot, I think that anything that we can do that indicates that this is, you know, that this is one of those areas that we want registrars to act in a certain manner, but we're not necessarily saying, hey, your accreditation is on the line if you don't follow procedure X, Y, and Z, I think that that would be helpful because there are a couple of areas here where we've said, you know, as a non-limiting example, and maybe we can even highlight that language a little bit more. Just because I know from a fact that just in the volumes of the automated systems that we have that this sort of scenario that we're describing, the good scenario of a minor change to WHOIS, not the bad scenario of a compromise, but the good scenario is happening dozens if not hundreds of times every day. And, you know, having any kind of a manual or a human-driven process in there that has to review all of these could slow down an already confusing process of transfer. So I want to make sure that we're trusting our registrars a little bit here and making sure that compliance is not now empowered to come after us for slip-ups on the part of our customers. Aubrey's next in the queue. Go ahead, Aubrey.
Thanks, Ms. Aubrey. Two considerations occur to me on this. A fair amount of work is done on authentication, and I'm wondering whether there's some way to sort of say not only just out-of-bound authentication, but an accepted, you know, finding an accepted method of authentication. There are many. Sometimes email is used, you know, and also even if one were using a telephone number, people can, you know, be at the other end of a telephone number, et cetera. So I think that just if we define that it has to be, you know, a sort of mainstream accepted method of authentication, something that has some background and some backing in among authentication experts, we may be, you know, giving enough of a clue without limiting people as to, you know, what they do. And so maybe just, consider sort of not approved methods of authentication, but, you know, accepted members of methods of authentication or some wording like that, so that one is not able to just say, well, I checked, but rather one is able to say, I use the following method, and the following method is a normally accepted method of authentication, and so on. So I'm not sure whether wording it in that way helps. We certainly don't want to try to make an exhaustive list of either the implicit or explicit attributes of proper authentication. Thanks.
Thanks, Aubrey. And I think that Mikey and I put some ideas in the chat there of generally accepted or industry accepted methods of authentication. Maybe language like that might help. Yeah. Okay, Michele, you're up next.
Yeah, just reacting to that thing from Avery, and I understand where she's coming from, but I'd be very, 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 very incredibly cautious about prescribing specifics. I'm not too happy with the generally accepted concept either. I'd prefer that when you look at implementation, that is something that, you know, you get the likes of ESSAC and co. to, you know, suggest possibly some kind of standard or whatever that might be suited. I mean, this kind of generally accepted thing is a bit fluffy, but ultimately, if the registrar is accepting responsibility to have done the authentication, it doesn't matter what authentication they've done, because they're still going to be liable for it. You know, so I wouldn't get too hung up on that, but I would still have issues. I mean, one of my main concerns, I think, is that anything that requires compliance input is going to cause problems, because I still think that compliance is under-resourced and isn't able to actually take action at present against certain types of activities, and putting more stuff on their plate is going to be more problematic in the future. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. And I think that Rob Golding, and there's a little bit of a little banter going on in the chat room here, but I think that it is correct that we don't want to require registrars to put in, let's say, some kind of biometric screening in order to change the registrant information, because now we've started to step down that very slippery slope of internet identity, which is a problem that governments and industry have been wrestling with, I know, at least for the last number of years, and it's certainly not this working group as capable our collection of experts and volunteers. I just don't think that this group is capable of addressing that particular problem. So I think that the key here, and I think Marika has marked up the language here, saying generally accepted method of authentication, which I'm okay with that. I think the only other change I would like to see, and I'm putting this out here as, I believe, a friendly amendment, but I'll leave it to Mikey to throw rocks at me, is that I would like to see the registrar, in its judgment, You know, I really feel like the missing piece here is some discretion on the part of the registrar to say that this is a minor, this is a typo fix, this is a, someone changing ST to street, et cetera. I wanted to get Mikey's thoughts on that and the group's thought on that, because I really feel that we need to, Michele can weigh in, but also, jurisdictional issues. What works in Ireland may not work in the U.S. and may not work in, some nations in Latin America or Africa. So I think that there is a necessary component there, and I see we're generating some traffic in the queue. So we'll go to Mikey. Go ahead.
And this is Mikey. I'm fine with that. The issue that I had was that I just want the registrant to be able to make that choice, rather than the registrar. So if a registrant says, you know, they're confronted in a user interface that says, is this a change of a registrant, or is this just you changing your personal information, or how, you know, I don't even want to go down the road of how you phrase it. But if the registrant says it's a minor change, and then it's up to, we add a dollop of registrar judgment to the mix, I'm fine with that. The thing I don't want to do is have registrars trying to guess whether this is a major change or a minor change, because I think down that road lurks the very thing that sent me up in the trees last time.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. Michele, you're up.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, apologies to Mikey, but he's not going to like this. I don't see how the registrant can be the one who decides what is a minor, what is a major change, because if I was trying to social engineer my way into gaining control of somebody's domains or other things, I'd obviously say that they were all minor changes. And if it's something that's going to be mandatory, obligatory part of policy and everything else, then it's my contract on the line, not theirs. Losing my RAA would not be a good thing. This would upset me greatly. Moving on to what Mr. Bledel was talking about with respect to jurisdictions and everything else, and also referring to some of Rob Golding's off-the-cuff comments in the chat. Thanks, Rob, by the way, you keep me sane at times. There's jurisdictional issues. It's going to be authentication methods that work better for some than for others. I know from some of the conversations we've had in other working groups that some registrars are literally taking registration requests and other things from their clients in shopping centres in Moscow. Certain types of people, they don't really do stuff online, they do it offline. I don't know if Matt Serlin's on the call. He's not, damn it. But, I mean, the likes of Mark Monitor and everything else, they don't take orders via websites, and as far as I know, they don't have control panels for people. I mean, it's all done using completely different methods. So, I mean, there has to be discretion. I mean, the key thing is that we as registrars are saying that we have conducted some level of validation, authentication, call it what you will, but I mean, ultimately it's our contract, our ability to conduct business that's put in threat if we actually screw it up. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Michele. And I think we capture that by saying in its judgment that we are saying that the registrar does have a role here in making the determination. And I think that should also address the jurisdictional problem, or at least give the registrar the flexibility to address their jurisdictional issues, if any. Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, I just thought I'd comment a little bit on the jurisdictional issue question, and just to make the point that this is not a governmental function. I mean, we're talking about essentially a contractual relationship, and it makes, I think, more sense to focus on a mechanism that's generally workable, obviously we don't want to create something that's going to conflict with, 99% of the jurisdictions in enforcing the contract. But on the other hand, I don't think that it's all something that we need to worry about whether the prescribed method, whether we leave it to judgment or we have a bright line test of what records need to have some sort of verification and what that verification complies. I think it's much more important to make it administratively feasible for the organization rather than worry about whether in specific jurisdictions it's going to raise a problem in enforcing the contractual relationship between the parties. So just my two cents, not to get too hung up on that, and I think it's better to think about things like, well, are we giving adequate flexibility, and do we have a standard that has some objectivity that, third parties can figure out whether or not, the registrar and the registrants are in compliance with the contract and the prescriptions that ICANN puts on that contract. So that's the end of my rant.
Well, thanks, Kevin, and I think it is an important distinction. Michele, we'll give you the last word on this because we need to...
No, I'm just going to keep this very, very short and to the point. Now, I think the thing with the jurisdiction, I think there's a little bit of confusion here. I think, like, Kevin, you've got to remember, we're not all lawyers, so I think James was referring to the fact that, certain things might be easy for me to do in Ireland that wouldn't be easy for you to do in the U.S. It's not, jurisdiction in terms of laws, it's more down to practicalities, just certain things. I mean, Rob's very friendly and all his registrants come into his office or something. I mean, I don't think it was the jurisdiction in a pure legal sense that James was referring to. Thanks.
Yeah, probably a bad term on my part, coming from a different venue, but I think I put in the chat here regional differences in address or, you know, personal information standards. So anyway, let's just kind of see if we can wrap this thing into a bring this thing into a fore landing. Let's take a look at the proposed language on the screen. And Marika, if I could ask you to lead through this one additional time, and we will, using the check marks in the Adobe, please indicate your acceptance of this language. So Marika, if you would, please.
It is, Marika. So the proposed language currently reads, in the case of minor updates or corrections, the registrar in his judgment may waive this requirement at the request of the registrant using a generally accepted method of authentication. The working group recommends that the IRTP Part C implementation review team is consulted by ICANN staff as it develops the implementation plan to ensure this recommendation is implemented in accordance with the intention of the working group.
Okay, Mikey says that we lost something here. We lost out of band. And I thought we had something in there about a non-limiting example. So with
This is Mikey. I think we took a little bit too much out. I don't think there was disagreement about some of the other, the second sentence. It was more clarifying. So, Marika, if you could yank back the original second sentence and stick it in there again. Yeah.
Okay, and I see that she has now reinserted that as a non-limiting example. Registrars may want to consider or may consider out-of-band authentication based on information that cannot be learned from within the registrar account or publicly available resources such as Whois. What is the general feeling of the working group? Can we live with this language? Mikey, does that address your concern? Does that put back enough? Does it put back too much? I got a green check mark from Mikey. That's saying something.
I'm in. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. I'm just going to check mark just based on that. I've got another one from Kevin, and here they come.
So, a check from Bob.
And a check from Bob behind the wheel. He's pushing the check button on his steering wheel there. Okay, so that one looks like we've arrived at something that we can all live with. So thank you for your work on that one, and thanks, Mikey, for taking that one off the starting that one on the list. Okay, Marika, do we have enough now to continue on to item number four?
Yes, I think we do. The one question I would have, but I would need to look at the exact language, do we want to update the other similar language that we have in the report that talks also about this issue about the out-of-band authentication part? Or maybe that's something we need to look at one more time now?
I think that if that sentence is mirrored elsewhere in the document, that we should change those instances to reflect what we just came up with here. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, exactly. Okay.
Okay. Okay. So next up is the final report in its in all of its glory. And if you recall, we had a kind of a draft final or a stake in the ground report in Prague in June, and now we have this report, which I believe, and Marika will certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe is a red line from that version, which is now appearing on your screen. I don't know if it's, are we talking now that item number four is to go through this report and go through the red line, Marika? Is that
This is Marika. Well, the idea was that people, you know, should have sent in any issues or concerns they had, you know, prior to this call, so we could look at those. So, you know, I don't know if this is a moment to actually ask people if, you know, they have any issues. I did receive, I think, one comment from Rob about a spelling mistake that I already corrected, and this version that's on the screen also already includes as an annex the case studies that that Mikey did in the PowerPoint format. So really the idea is to see if there's anything else remaining apart from, you know, updating the language that we just discussed, also reflecting that in the other parts that use that similar kind of language of the out-of-bound authentication mechanisms to see if there's anything else that is remaining at this point in time that needs to be reviewed, that needs to be looked at or you know, refined, or whether working group members are happy with the report as it currently stands.
Okay, thank you. So it seems like it would make a little bit more sense if we jump ahead to item number 5, which is just poll the group and see if there are any open or remaining issues that folks feel have not been addressed before we do a consensus review. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, consensus review also includes Aubrey and I making this determination of the level of consensus for each of our recommendations. And if that's true, then I had some thoughts on that I wanted to share with the group. So does it make sense to jump ahead to item number 5? I don't see any strong opinions on that. So the question is, are there any other open issues from our list or from any of the current deliberations that folks believe that we have omitted or neglected in this discussion? And I don't know if we have that list handy, Marika, where we can take a look, almost like our shopping list of open questions, and make sure that we have covered those to everyone's satisfaction. So here we are. So looking at the first one, document visual representation of the transfer process, thanks to Mikey and the sub-team, I think we've got an excellent response to that question. Further consideration to the change of registrant policy and suggested restrictions for change of registrar immediately following a change of registrant. I think we beat that horse to death and then dug him up and then beat him some more. Further consideration of which updates constitute a change of ownership, taking into account comments 5, 6, and 12. I think that's what we were wrapping up today. Item number 4, consideration of how to address fixing mistakes, spelling errors as part of the change of registrant process, change of registrant policy, again, what we discussed today. Number 5, should policy apply equally to registrar resellers? I don't know that we spent a whole lot of time on this, but the general position of registrars, and I believe others, is that the registrar of record or domain name is ultimately responsible completely and 100% for the actions associated with a domain name, and that anyone who is a third party or a reseller, et cetera, that is also involved is also the responsibility of that registrant. So we can spend a little bit more time on this, but I think that registrars frequently want to point out that if there's a registrar out there hiding behind their reseller, then compliance should be going after them. Mike McKelly, I see your hand up. Go ahead, please.
Just so that you don't sound like it's just you saying that, I will agree with you 100%. The general position taken by by registrars, and I believe this is also the position of the registrar stakeholder group in any discussions related to the RAA and everything else, is that the registrar is responsible for all domains under accreditation. While they may wish to delegate various parts of that, ultimately they will always be responsible for them. So I'm backing you up. Thanks.
Thanks, McKelly. That's correct. I think another way of saying it is if you're a registrar and you decide to take on a reseller, you do so at your own risk. So, Rob, go ahead.
I'm going to have to agree as well. It ultimately is the registrar's responsibilities to the registrant and on behalf of the registry. And to use a colloquialism, it's the registrar's balls in the vice. If somebody's going to do something wrong, that's going to get tightened. So I think the registrar has to take the final responsibility and can't hide behind, well, we only deal with resellers or whatever other excuses people might give.
Thank you, Rob. I agree completely, and I can't wait to see the translation of that. Okay, so I think we're all, especially the registrars on the call, are violently agreeing with each other on this. So let's then go to item number 6. Should the registrant policy be separate from IRTP or combined with the IRTP? I think we landed on what we were calling the hybrid policy, which was essentially a combined policy, but with clearer delineations between the section that refers to change of registrar and the sections that refer to change of registrant. Number seven, consideration whether there should be different provisions when it concerns an organization or company instead of an individual that requests a change. I don't know that we spent a lot of time on that. Did we co-mingle that with this discussion about minor changes versus major changes? Anyone want to help us on that? Mikey, can you refresh my memory on that?
This is Mikey. I would say that we did not commingle it. I wasn't thinking about that at all, actually, when I was writing all that stuff and drawing those pictures. I never really understood the rationale for treating organization differently than individual, so this is a pretty low-priority item for me, and I certainly didn't consider it.
Okay. Let's go to Marika, see if she can shed some light here. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm trying to find the language, but I think we might have addressed it by clarifying somewhere that, you know, the change of registrant can also be requested by an authorized representative of the registrant. I don't know if that partly addresses the fact that if it's a company and not an individual asking the change, I don't know if that to a certain extent addresses that.
Well, can we... in the interest of time, can we ask Marika to take a look? And then otherwise, if we can't find any reference to this, then I suggest that we need to put that on our onto the mailing list as an item to be discussed, as quickly as possible. Because if we drop the ball on that one, I think we need to perhaps go back and make sure we take a look at the comment and make sure we have covered that one. Because I don't really remember that as well. Okay, so Mary just posted the language in the chat, which is what we currently have in the report is a change of registrant can only be requested by the registrant or an authorized representative of the registrant. I think it's that latter part that we're saying is applicable in the event that the registrant is an organization. And where does that language currently reside, Marika?
This is Marika. That resides as part of one of the notes in the report in relation to the recommendation on charter question A. And I actually just quickly looked back at the comments, and this is indeed specifically the point that I think the registry stakeholder group was making. And I think indeed as a result we said we should clarify that it's the authorized party, person or organization that's the only legal entity that can implement a change of control. So change it to a registrant or authorized representative. So I don't know, the registry stakeholder group representative on the call might confirm if this is sufficient or whether there's anything else that needs to be included in the report to clarify that point.
Okay, two questions. The first would be to the registry representatives, Paul and Barbara, and I believe Roy is also on the call, to see if that addresses that concern. And then the second question would be to Simonetta, which she's raised in the chat, whether or not we have sufficiently defined registrants in the report so that's not limiting to individuals. So any of our registry reps want to weigh in on the first part there? Crickets. Oh, there we go, Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hey, James, it's Paul. I don't think there's a problem, but this is one that I think I want to run past the rest of the group first. And we have our call tomorrow, so I can post to the list just to make sure that I'm not off base and saying that there's no issue.
Okay. Can you maybe copy-paste what Marika had there in the chat and make sure that they're comfortable with that language?
Sure.
Okay. Mikey posted that he's not really keen on this group defining registrant. I don't know that we're defining it here, Mikey. I think it's already defined perhaps in the RAA. So anything we would do perhaps would reference that or echo that here in the report. And I think Mikey's okay with that. I think that would also address some of Aneta's concerns that we're being too limiting when we refer to change of registrant. So, yes, Mikey, I agree with you that we're not tweaking the definition of registered name holder. That already exists. Marika, does that help?
I'm sorry. Are you suggesting that I should make any changes to the report, or?
I think that the language that you found, Paul, is going to confirm that that addresses the registry comment in this area.
Right. Okay.
And but I think we can leave it in there for the time being, and then just wanted to confirm that we, you know, at some point when we say registrants, that we are. Our intention, if not explicitly, is at least implicitly referring back to the definition of registered name holder from the RAA.
Okay, so I think that fits somewhere in a footnote, I guess, at the start of when we talk about mentioned registrants. It might be appropriate there then to list, as defined in the RAA.
Perfect, because I think what we don't want to do is give the implication that with all of this new process that we are changing the definition of who the registrant is. And I think it is important when contrasted with the inter-registrar policy, which can be initiated by either the registered name holder or the admin contact. So I think that, you know, it's clear we need to separate that this is a role or a process that's the exclusive right of the registrant. But I think that just as you mentioned, just a reference or a footnote to the RAA definition will be sufficient just to ensure that we're not tweaking a new definition here inadvertently. Number 8, revisit the use of primary contact method on page 23 of the initial report. Can you help me with page 23 of the initial report? What is the context for the use of primary contact method?
This is Marika. I think this comes also back to the which changes are made, and I think it specifically relates to specifying that primary contact method is registrant and or administrative contact email address. That's what we clarified, I think, as a result of that.
Okay. So this is also a function of the minor changes or updates versus a material change to the registrant primary contact method.
Right.
Okay. Item number 9 is further consideration of the use of auth info code as the change of registrant credentials to validate the authorization of the registrant to effect the change. I think we addressed this. Simonetta actually put us on the path to some language here where we discussed the it wasn't necessarily something that was chiseled into our recommendation, but it did reference the idea that FOA and the auth info codes have a different relationship perhaps than they were originally intended to have, and that the auth info code, especially in EPP registries, was in many cases the de facto credential that validated that the party was authorized to transfer the name or change the registrant. So I think we're covered there with that language, but I think if there's anyone here that feels like that I'm missing the point of item number 9 or that we needed more language there, please let me know. MTQ, I think we hit this one. And then one recommendation for item number 2, which was the transfer process and how auth info codes and FOAs influence the transfer process. That's part of the clarifying language that we developed in response to that. I don't know if item number 9 and item number 10 are related or if I'm missing some distinction between them. Marika, is this do you feel like we've covered item number 9? I know we've put item number 10 to bed. Still don't see any.
This is Marika. I think we basically left that now more open and saying that I guess could be one of the, how did we call it, the accepted authentication methods. But I don't think we went into that much detail to mandate that or require it, as far as I recall.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. So that's our hit list that we came out of the review of the public comments. We came out with this list, and then we worked this list, and it looks like we've, with maybe one or two follow-up items, one for Paul, and then we'll take a look at item number 9 again, just to make sure it's covered. I think we've put this list to bed. So the question then falls to the group. It is now, I think, it now falls to myself and Avery, as co-chairs of this group, to determine which of our recommendations has, I'm going to struggle a little bit here. I think the categories are unanimous support, full consensus, rough consensus with minority report or minority opinions, and then multiple minority opinions or something like that, and then no consensus. And, you know, there's probably a sliding scale, and, of course, it's all completely fuzzy logic where those boundaries are between those different categories. So I would propose to this group that, one, that we have achieved consensus on our recommendations. Two, that while some of them may be unanimous, we may be avoid using that particular term in our report, because I don't know that it necessarily adds any more validity to a recommendation to say it was unanimous versus to say you had full consensus. So what I'm proposing to the group is that Avery and I review the recommendations and that we make a determination of whether or not we have full consensus, using that term to identify or to label all of our recommendations, understanding that some may be unanimous, but we can always fall back to full consensus. The only catch is that if there is anything in our recommendations that warrants any kind of a minority report, we want to make sure we don't sweep anything like that under the rug. So my question to the group would be, what do you think of this approach, number one? And two, does anyone want to take some time, review the recommendations, and consider whether or not they want to attach a minority statement to any of these recommendations? Because that would, I think, drop the consensus recommendation from full to rough. If anyone feels like, you know, this is definitely me coloring outside the lines a little bit here, and I haven't discussed this with Marika and Avery, but I do think that in the interest of expediency, we can possibly, push forward with this approach, and it would certainly get us to the same place a lot faster. I will defer to co-chair and staff and the rest of the group on this. So, Avery, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. and thanks for jumping in with a proposal on it. I think that's actually a really good idea. I think that you and I should do that. I think that next week, and by the way, I can take the call, what I can do, we should put that out on the list. And then next week I can, walk through, again, recommendation by recommendation, say, we put this at this level, agree, disagree, issues, et cetera. So basically do a walkthrough and just make sure that anyone that does have an issue. I'd like to add one other thing, and that's making your recommendation that people start thinking about places where they have minority opinions or other supported opinions, to actually ask those people to sort of declare in the next week that they have it on a particular issue, and then start writing their opinion so that we can, get that in, get that attached to the document, et cetera. I think it's the last thing we do is, there's consensus, there's general consensus on the agreements if we have that. And I believe we do, but we need to go through it. And then there's also making sure that we have consensus on the document, which means at that point that people agree that our projections of what the consensus level was or wasn't is considered accurate, with it, and that it does contain any of the necessary minority and other opinions that people need to add, because that's the step we need to get to sort of say we have consensus on the document. So there's consensus on the agreement, on the recommendations, and then there's consensus that the document portrays it correctly.
Okay, thanks, Avery. I think those are really important points. May I suggest that we do a couple things. First off is to anyone on the call, or Marika maybe can send this to the list, that if you intend to submit a minority statement, that we get the commitment to do so by a certain date. Let's say by, what do we think is appropriate, by the end of this week, by Friday. I know that we're in trouble there. At least have the commitment that we will have a minority statement by the end of this week. Now, the minority statement itself obviously may not be ready for Toronto, but if we can at least have the commitment to say that, you know, on this recommendation there's a minority statement forthcoming from person X or party Y, I think that would be helpful. The other thing is, as Aubrey points out, is that we then have to get consensus on the overall document. And I think if we have minority statements still outstanding, well, we should still be able to do that, I think. So maybe we could take a look at that. What I will do in the interim, I'll just assume that I am selected to serve next week, and I will send Aubrey and Marika my gauge of a consensus level for each of the recommendations, and I'll make sure that you have that, Aubrey, so that only in those cases where there's a departure from those do we have to say we have to go back and make a consensus call or something. But I feel pretty confident that we're past that point and that we've hammered out the language that everyone can agree upon. But we should make sure that we leave the window open as long as possible if there's someone who just simply cannot abide by any of these recommendations or some of the language, wants to see a change there. So does that make sense that we would put out a deadline by the end of this week to notify us of the intention to submit a minority statement? And then we should probably have some follow-up deadline for actually submitting the minority statement, which can be like the Friday of the week after after Toronto or something like that. I don't know if that works out for everyone. No idea what the council schedule looks like, or if they're going to appreciate the reprieve, or if they're going to get very upset. Aubrey and Marika are in the queue. Aubrey, can we go to Marika first?
Marika was there first.
Okay, go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, then this is Marika, and my proposal will be that I push out an updated final version of the report to the list either later today or first thing tomorrow morning my time here in Europe. Indeed, with the question saying, look, this is the final version. If you have any objections to anything in this report, speak now. If you want to submit minority reports, please let the group know so by the end of this week. And I guess based on the feedback received there, we can assess on the Tuesday call what the level of consensus is for the report and the recommendations. In addition, if we indeed manage to finalize the report, it would be good then if we can submit that next Tuesday, which is also the deadline for submission of documents to the GNSO Council for them to consider in Toronto. And what I can do at the same time is prepare a draft motion for the adoption of these recommendations, just to serve as a starting point for the conversation that the Council can have on these recommendations with the working group and as well amongst themselves in Toronto.
Okay, thank you, Marika. I think those are good plans. Aubrey, go ahead.
Yeah. I think in the best of all possible worlds, that timing works out. I think, first of all, I think you were a little lenient in the minority statements. I think that people should raise their hand by this Friday and should have it, especially with the schedule that Marika is suggesting, that they would have submitted it by Tuesday and not sometime after Toronto. I think after Toronto, if we get what we're looking for, there'll be comment periods and whatever to go further on. But I think at this point, anybody in this group that still feels that, the consensus went about as far as it could, but they're still not quite happy, probably knows it. And so I'd like to ask that to be done by Tuesday. So if we're putting out a document on Tuesday, we're putting out a document that contains those as well. I think that if I can do the walkthrough next Tuesday with everybody agreeing with the level of consensus, then I think we're fine submitting it for the motion, still submitting the document. But if we need, you know, a couple more days to get a full tally of actually having consensus on the document, you know, I'm not sure that we won't have to pull the motion if we are not certain. But if at the end of next Tuesday we could say, yep, you know, this document accurately reflects what we think, yep, it contains the minority statement and it's ready to go, then I think, you know, following Marika's proposed schedule would be the best of all possible worlds. But I'm just adding a note of caution.
Okay, thanks, Avery. And I do like the idea that, you know, we put in a hard deadline of next Tuesday to actually submit the minority statement. I think that given the amount of work that Marika is doing in crunch time, and this is not her only working group, I think that that's the least we can ask of anyone who's, you know, intention is to submit a minority statement. So I think that's a good point. Okay, so
Tuesday deadline. I'd like to see a red check from anyone that objects to that Tuesday deadline for minority statement. I see no red checks. Okay, good. When we were putting a tight deadline on people, I just wanted to give them a chance to shout.
No, that's good, and I appreciate that. And so let's send Marika send out that message that by Friday, anyone interested in submitting a minority statement must indicate their intentions and also indicate where in the report, which recommendation, page, et cetera, that they intend to do so. This, of course, presumes that you will have a new report out by the end of the day or early tomorrow, and that the statement itself would then be done by, are we saying by our call, Aubrey? Next Tuesday?
Yeah.
Okay, so before the call next Tuesday. So that it can be introduced. So it must be submitted to Marika and to the list by next Tuesday.
And, of course, nobody has to agree to a minority statement other than the person submitting it. So it's really just informative at that point.
Right, absolutely. And then my homework will be to send my impressions of the consensus to Avery and Marika so that when they leave the call next week that they know where I am so that they, you know, they can proceed without me. Sound good, everyone?
No objections.
No objections. Excellent. Okay, well, thanks, everyone, for pressing through this. We're very near the end here. The finish line is in sight, and let's get these last bits of work taken care of, and appreciate your efforts and patience, as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Way to go, everybody.
Just want to point out that if we do get it done, we will have completed in almost a year, which might be close to a record.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. I agree.
Well, here's hoping.
Here's hoping.
See when we get back by Friday.
Right.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Bye.